The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
We are halfway through the Friday show right here on 18 November, heading into next week, which is Thanksgiving week. I'm going to be replaced at 10 o'clock by Charlie Kirk, and then we go Prager at 11, Gorka at 1, and then we get to go live and local with Deb at 3 o'clock. Take a listen to that show if you haven't. That's a great hour of radio. Followed by at 4 o'clock, it's normally Stefan Tubes, as Hugh calls him, but Stefan's still under the weather. By the way, is it unusual to anyone other than me that Stefan's out under the weather, Billy's out under the weather, and you know who the missing person of that little Three Musketeers? How about Jared Polis? He's out now, too. God, I wonder what's going on with those guys. That's the true conspiracy. Stefan, Billy, and Jared. That's what's going on. There is a leftward influence here at Salem, and it starts with the governor. Nonetheless, at 4 o'clock, I think we're going to have Jimmy Sengenberger back in. That's if his car isn't stolen for a fourth time, you know, I think in like 2 years. So stay tuned and listen to Jimmy. Now, listen, I'm thrilled to have on the radio, on the VIP line, he is top of the Billboard guy, American singer, songwriter. Maybe his biggest hit is Under the Influence from 2019, Chris Brown. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, George.
Chris, you sound way different than your pictures would make me think you sound.
You might be disappointing your listeners here a little bit.
This isn't Chris Brown, American singer, songwriter?
I've had to combat that for some time. No. We're going to talk about a much different topic than the American hits. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This is probably why it's important I read the papers before I start running my mouth. This is actually Chris Brown, who is, what's it called, Vice President of All Things Data? What's your title?
You're close enough, George. Policy and Research, Vice President of Policy and Research here at the Common Sense Institute.
Now, people have heard you before on here, and what they know is Common Sense Institute is, I'm going to use a term you and I have referenced, and so is the media, punching way above its weight. But you guys analyze a bunch of things from a nonpartisan, really data-driven point of view, and that is to try to assess how policies impact the broader economy. And one of the things that CSI has done in this past year has been great, is to focus on the economic impact of rising crime rates. But that's not all you do. That's just some of the highest profile stuff you do. Some of the other things that you do are to tackle homelessness and the topic that we're going to talk about now, which is about this public option for health insurance. And you guys just, I think it was yesterday, just released a pretty important report. And I want to say that this was unexpected, but for the people that were opposed to the public option thing, these were all things we thought might be coming down the road. You guys have just done a really deep dive on it. So with that introduction, do the folks at 710 a favor and set the stage for how did we get to this place? And then we'll talk about what you see coming down the road. Can we do that?
Yeah, happy to. And I think you nailed it. Now, before I get into the Colorado option discussion, you know, as you said, here at CSI, you know, our focus is looking at Colorado state and local public policy through the lens of free enterprise, through the lens of economic analysis. We care about the preserving and growing the Colorado economy. And we take on and do work on a wide range of issues. And I just want to plug, I appreciated your conversation yesterday with Commander Greenwell, looking at talking about auto theft. I shared that conversation with the team and some of the information and stats that he provided. So found that very compelling. And again, another part of the work that we do. But I think as you summarized, we've been doing work on the Carter option, or as it was originally sort of referred to, the public option debate, since 2019. And this is a policy which has been floated at the federal level. Washington State was one of the first states, if not the first state, to create a quasi or so-called public option plan. Colorado became the second to create a new, more regulated health insurance plan that is mandated to be sold in the individual and small group health insurance markets. So this is a plan which is, and we'll get into our research, which is set to be available for purchase for starting in 2023. But as you said, we've looked at this from the standpoint, the mechanisms that are used in the regulation with price controls, mandates, we've anticipated and modeled out, and not just us, but many others have looked at the unintended consequences of this change within our healthcare market. And as you said, we're now starting to see that play out.
So what's the goal here? What was at least the stated purpose? I have my own belief that this is just the camel's nose under the tent of trying to get to single-payer universal coverage. That's my belief. But you don't have to go down that road. What was the stated intent of the legislators who put this thing out there?
Well, you know, if you read the text of the legislation and some of the information put out, you know, on advocates, right, this is improving competition, lowering prices, right? This is the goal, to make health insurance more affordable for consumers is the stated goal. And what we are now seeing is that that for some consumers, a very limited number of consumers in some markets, there are some savings, but there are broader impacts across the rest of the insurance market and to providers, health insurance providers, hospitals, doctors, physicians that are not really reflected in these initial sort of price premium disclosures.
How did you tackle this thing then when you're trying? And the story isn't so much about what reality is now. It does talk about that. But really the point of this, the purpose of this is to say, hey, folks, we have seriously underestimated a couple different things that had we, I guess, known this ahead of time, maybe we would have changed some decision making. Is that part of this? Or are you suggesting there's a way to fix this legislation so that it doesn't crush us in the future?
Well, I'll start with your second question first. I mean, we have offered and talked about some incremental changes to the way the rules were finalized, specifically changing the allowable premium growth rate, which is now based on sort of a 10-year national average of medical inflation, which we don't think appropriately reflects what healthcare providers are actually facing in terms of cost on any single year basis. So those are tweaks. Those are detailed tweaks. But really, I think there are other reforms. There are reforms to this measure. But I don't think it's any single policy change that needs to occur to improve this. Really, what we need to see is, you know, an agreement and a change of course where we are empowering consumers rather than sort of simply increasing subsidization and further restricting health insurance carriers and medical providers. I mean, I think we all want more affordable health insurance coverage and high quality care, but we need to embrace in many ways sort of a different philosophy and set of values when it comes to regulating healthcare. Our hope is that studies like this that look at the numbers, that strictly look at the numbers and we see the unintended consequences, you know, our lawmakers and Coloradans will be open to alternative approaches.
I want to make sure, though, that hold on. I just want to make sure that folks understand unintended consequences doesn't mean unanticipatable or unknown consequences. These things that you guys have now put numbers to were things that were predicted before this thing happened. Like there was no way that the legislature was going to craft something like this that was going to keep costs where they wanted them and to address inflation the way they wanted to. And that's the part I was hoping you'd get to. I probably just cut you off for that. Sorry, Chris.
Well, no, you're right. I think when the main, so, you know, maybe we didn't introduce the code option for your listeners well enough, but this is a new standardized plan that they just went through a state and stakeholders went through a regulatory process to define
health plan.
What is included in this plan, a health insurance plan. That's right. that has to be sold. Private insurance companies are required, if they want to operate in Colorado, required to sell this as part of their offerings in the individual and small group market. And small group means are plans that are large, that are utilized by small businesses, not large large companies with hundreds and thousands of employees, but smaller business startups that need sort of a group plan. You have to sell this plan, and the state says, well, you have to reduce the premium by 5% this year against your 2021 baseline, and that grows up to 15% in over the next 2 years. So this is a price cap on a product sold by private carriers. And again, those unintended consequences were, as you said, not necessarily unanticipated, where we've seen now at least four different health insurance carriers leave the market to the point where going on and purchasing insurance now is, we have open enrollment. Coloradans are going in, those that purchase individual small group plans, we'll see that there are many will have already received letters that their carriers are not operating in Colorado. There are 91 fewer plans available across the state. And so we're seeing this reduction in the number of plans, which is really a reflection of the challenges of operating in Colorado with not just the Colorado Option Plan, but other regulatory changes we've seen that are increasing costs.
Let's do a couple of these headline things here. Like, one of the things in this report are caps on medical inflation are likely lower than projected annual cost increases. First, describe what the heck that means and why does it matter to this bill?
So the bill says you have to sell this plan and your premium is allowed to increase annually at the rate of this 10-year average of medical inflation. Well, that 10-year average is about 3%.
And by the way, that's not an average that's generated from Colorado. It's not a reflection of actual costs. It's a decade-long look back across the nation as if that dictates the kind of inflation we're seeing here in Colorado.
That's right. And clearly, anyone paying attention would know that the rate that we're seeing costs increase, that impacts the cost of medical devices, of medical equipment, of labor, of electricity to provide the service of healthcare are more than significantly higher than that allowable growth rate. So that's one factor that makes it where we are restricting the price that we pay for our healthcare, but we are not addressing the underlying cost of delivering that care.
So here's something else. The insurance premium growth cap is much lower than the projected rate of medical cost trends. Describe that, but then tell us, what are the ramifications for this? What must happen next since we have so poorly judged or at least accounted for the true amount of inflation?
Well, again, I think a small change would be to look at that rate that's in the legislation in relation to what costs have actually been, and then you could modify that cap. Now, capping prices and regulating prices in this way often leads to these sorts of unintended consequences, reducing supply and increasing costs elsewhere. This is, akin, and it might be a bad analogy, but it's similar to rent control in housing, right? You save, you regulate a price, and what happens is you restrict supply and you force costs elsewhere in the market. So the unintended consequence and anticipated consequence that we really think Coloradans, legislators need to be cognizant of is not just this year when there's the 5% reduction, but over the next 2 years as health carriers are required to now reduce their premiums by an additional 10% below this 2021 baseline. We think bottom line, medical providers will be forced or face difficult choices to cut costs in a way that impacts quality and access, or they'll pass on costs to the remaining private insurance market through other through higher prices to other plans, largely large employer plans.
Now we're talking with Chris Brown. He's the vice president of numbers and stuff from Common Sense Institute. And Chris, what I hear you twofold though, what I hear you saying, and I'm gonna push something a little bit farther. You keep saying unintended, and I appreciate that you're saying that. I don't think this is unintended. I do believe that this has always been the goal of the lefties in the legislature to try to create an environment where it becomes so economically unfeasible for whether it's providers or private health care companies or anything to survive in the market that they move on, further reducing choice and further putting burdens on the government to come up with a way to cover more and more people. So what you just described is a place where the costs are going to be so much higher than can be recovered under this plan that the private health insurance companies are going to have to turn to you and me and jack our prices up to cover for that garbage state provided plan or mandated plan. Over time, the other tough decision that you haven't touched on yet, and I imagine you were getting there, is going to be they're just going to say, we're out. Can't make money in Colorado. We're leaving. And with that, less competition becomes greater pressure on the Colorado option and, frankly, on the government to say, well, man, we got to figure out a way to fund this now. I just think this was, and maybe I'm just a giant conspiracy theory on the health insurance thing, but this is all planned.
Well, you know, I'll have to say that there was, you know, there was substantial debate on this issue at the legislature when this went through. And a lot of these concerns came out. There was a lot of pushback, both, you know, by Republican and Democratic legislators. And many got this. Many understood these potential consequences. I'm not sure that everyone anticipated how quickly or how severe some of this impacts would be. But I do think that there was robust debate. And so I do think a lot of it may come down to difference of values and again, why I come back to the idea that we need to be thinking more broadly about how we regulate health insurance, which is not imposing the stricter controls on health insurance carriers and providers. But as you said, you know, we've seen already four health insurance carriers have left one or both. So either the individual or small group markets this year, and that's partially attributed to the call option plan and others as well. But we expect, you know, when stricter price controls come into effect next year and the following year, this will be even more difficult for carriers, health insurance carriers, and to operate, which will put greater pressure on hospitals and providers. And I think one element that we studied that we don't have the full numbers of the final rates and how this is playing out across the state. The state has disclosed some information, but not necessarily all plan prices across all regions. But the dynamic in rural Colorado, in the mountain communities, will likely be even more stressed. And I think that's an important dynamic that, you know, we again hope to study, that this is not just going to impact everyone the same, but in places where you already have more challenges providing care, you have smaller populations, it's harder to maintain a certain level of services, this will constrain that even more.
Here's something. You have this chart in here that's called Hospital Reimbursement in 46 States and the Colorado Option Proposal. And it shows Colorado kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of percentage of Medicare reimbursement for hospitals, which matters. The Colorado option has dropped off the far right of this thing. Like, it is teeny tiny and way to the right. It's lower than any other state, including, I think that's Arkansas. I just don't know how the government can suggest to hospitals, you should do this and it's good for you to do it, other than mandating that they do it. And to shift costs, once again, this is an intentional effort to redistribute the cost for just about everything from those who they think deserve it. I mean, from those who don't deserve it to those who do. And they're going to make you and I pay for it, Chris. Now, again, I know that you guys are nonpartisan enough. You're not going to jump in on this. But I just think this was all part of a broader plan that in a short period of time, even though you're right and you're going to continue to hold a mirror up to these folks on this thing, they're just going to shrug their way all the way through all of these hospitals either closing down or becoming co-opted by some larger group, or we're going to see a decreased amount of competition such that at the end of the day, the only option is going to be the state option. That's my soapbox. I don't want you to echo it. I just want you to tell us, what do you think the future holds?
Well, that's a great question. And I think, you know, we will see what comes up this year because there's going to be a reaction. I mean, health insurance rates are going up by more than 10% in the individual market still. I think, you know, just a few more, I think, important numbers for context. When we saw the final 2023 rates just a few weeks ago, the press release claimed there was more than $326 million in savings for health consumers across Colorado. But when you just look at those numbers in the press release, 90% of those savings come from a program that already exists.
That's Colorado's. Who saw that coming?
That's Colorado's reinsurance program, right?
Right.
In effect for 2 years, which has been effective at bringing down, the governor champion has been effective in bringing down premiums. There's complications and issues with it. But the purported savings for consumers from the Cutter Option Plan were about $14.7 million, or less than 5%. And that would that was based on if consumers chose to move to the Cutter Option Plan, which would be less expensive than, say, the plan they're currently on. However, there are other plans in each metal tier, so in the type of plan design that these Cutter Option Plans are offered, that it would be less expensive. So theoretically, consumers would save more if they move to non-Cutter Option Plans. But there are reasons why we don't move, because we like our doctor, we like our network, we want to keep our plan, we don't want to have the headache. And so, you know, it's, I think we just need to have transparency and honest conversation about the degree to which we are A, seeing savings, and B, we're seeing some of these unintended consequences or anticipated, that I think over the next year or two will only grow.
Couple predictions here. One, this is not going to be the last report you guys generate on this. You're really good about updating the information as things progress along. Two, the left will hate you once again for this and come out and decry your math and numbers without ever giving any alternatives. Those are my two predictions.
Well, you know, look, we want to have a conversation with anybody and everybody. That includes, you know, state leadership, the state legislature. And we think that they're, you know, people will look at this and say, look, we don't want this to happen either. So we are hopeful that we can have these conversations, have sensible reforms. So, you know, again, we will see what the next step is. But, you know, I think that when you look at these numbers and others do, I'm hopeful we can see a path forward so that we can, you know, move to what we all want, which is affordable coverage and high quality care.
Hey, can I ask you one thing? A texter has come in here. I know we've gone a little bit long, Chris, but I love the topic. It says, ask Chris about the provision in the legislation that allows the state to take over the standard option plan when or if the carriers can't hit the price reduction targets.
Yeah, that's exactly a massive risk to this. And we haven't, to my knowledge, seen that happen, again, to my knowledge. But again, over the next year or two, as we see the price reduction mandates get stricter, that you may see some plans in certain regions that can't achieve the premium level that is required. And they'll say, look, if you want to have a plan at all in this community, in the individual or small group market, there's a provision, as your texter said, that would allow the state to come in and essentially dictate or negotiate or dictate prices for hospitals in that region to accept lower rates.
And it's fair when the government negotiates, Chris, because they don't have the power to tax people to make up any shortfall. Oh, wait, they don't have the ability to mandate through law that you... No, never mind. Go ahead.
Well, it is a huge risk and concern. And I think anyone, you know, if you're in healthcare, be aware of this and understand it. But just what I also encourage people to do, you know, whatever business you're in, sort of consider if there was a provision that said, look, you have to sell your product at a certain price, and if you don't, we will come in and negotiate with your suppliers and sort of force down the chain changes. And that's what's happening. And I think who's the body that
regulates this, Chris? Who is the entity? Is it one that's already existing? Was it created out of this legislation?
It's primarily through the Division of Insurance, so already existing entity.
Yeah. Looking good. You know, if you like what the government's done with fill in the blank, you're going to love what they do with your health insurance. Chris Brown, Vice President of All Things Super Smart at the Common Sense Institute. People can go to commonsenseinstitute.org. I'm sorry, that's a lie. commonsenseinstituteco.org. And the CO is for Colorado, and that's important because you guys are blowing up everywhere all over the country. These things are popping up everywhere. Go to commonsenseinstituteco.org to download at least the executive summary. Read this thing. It's eye-opening and it's concerning, but it's also important that we have that information out there. Thanks, man, for what you do.
Great. Thank you, George.
Have a great Thanksgiving, Chris. Hey, listen, we went a little bit long, but that's just sort of how it goes these days. We're going to come back. You got thoughts on this? 303-696-1971. I'm not even sure how to stop it now that we've got a Capitol that is just drowning in blue over there. I think we have two Republicans in the entire state of Colorado anymore. It's hard to know. Give us a call, 303-696-1971. George Brockman on The George Show, 710 KNUS. Welcome back to 710 KNUS. Deb Flora. On at three. That's not me. No, I'm George Brockley right here on The George Show. We've got a bunch of texts coming in. One texter in particular I'm going back and forth with on some Ukraine stuff. And happy to do that, by the way. Happy to engage when you text me with something that's worth engaging on. I just want to be crystal clear that if you make an allegation, all I'm ever going to ask you to do before we move on is to prove it. So if you say we've lost freedoms because of Ukraine, I'm going to ask what freedoms and how. And if it takes 10 texts to get to the conclusion that you don't have the proof, we'll get there. It's not helpful to the conversation to just make these big histrionic, hyperbolic type statements. And that's it. You brought the emotion, you brought the drama, but you didn't bring the proof. That's a tough part. Now, listen, I want to shift gears just a little bit there. If you open the paper, to the extent that you still have a paper, and maybe that's now going to be a euphemism for just going online and checking, you can take a look at any number of crimes that are being committed. And what it feels like is going on is we are seeing a resurgence in high profile crimes being committed by juveniles or younger adults. So, for instance, in Lakewood, here's a story right now in the Gazette that talks about the fact that juveniles who pushed man off RTD light rail in Lakewood charged with assault. Now, in this particular case, it references the victim by name. It's a 45-year-old dude who apparently suffered some serious injuries when he was by a bunch of hooligans out there shoved off of a platform at about West 13th Avenue in Garrison in Lakewood. I know that area pretty well. Belmar Elementary, where I went, is 855 South Garrison. It's just some block south of there. Lakewood police responded. Now, when you do not see the names of the offenders in the paper here or online, it's because they're not yet being prosecuted as adults. They may never be prosecuted as adults. So when it says juveniles who push man off RTD light rail in Lakewood charged with assault, it's irrelevant unless they're prosecuted as adults. And here's why. Unless you're charged as an aggravated juvenile offender or a violent juvenile offender, every single charge spends the exact same way in the juvenile world. Misdemeanor, felony, doesn't matter. Unless you get tagged with something super big, like a violent juvenile offender, aggravated juvenile offender, the sentencing range is de minimis. And the chances that any of these folks are going to spend any time placed outside of their home, and that's what we call it, is really, really diminished. And so this story here, it's helpful, but it doesn't give the full perspective. And so when I read it, I thought to myself, you know, this is a big blind spot for the media. because the media does not truly understand the difference between when someone is prosecuted as a kid versus someone who's prosecuted as an adult. And the largest consequences aren't necessarily the permanence of the felony conviction, although that's a legitimate issue, because when you're a juvenile, you don't get convicted. We don't even use the term defendant in the juvenile justice system. Instead, you get adjudicated. And almost every single adjudication that takes place in the state of Colorado is sealable. That means kept from everyone else in the future, with some exceptions. But the vast, vast, vast majority of all charges, and there's good reason for that. And I don't want to say that there isn't. There is good reason for that, and that is kids do stupid things and make mistakes. And when they do, we want them to be held accountable, but we want them to be rehabbed more than that so that they can go out in the world and do things that they wouldn't have done as kids. We've all been there. You can probably name half a dozen or a dozen things, if you're Kelly, maybe twice that many that you've done that could have been criminally prosecuted, but you lucked out of it and you grew out of it. And there are some folks out there who get into the juvenile justice system who grow out of it and some who don't. But when you have this kind of a situation where a bunch of these knuckleheads get together and shove a dude down onto a light rail, could be to his death, but in this case it was to just injury, and they're charged with second degree assault. And you should know, second degree assault presupposes one of two things. There was a deadly weapon involved, and in this case it doesn't sound like there was, or there was serious bodily injury, not a paper cut, not just a little bleeding wound, serious bodily injury, which tends to be a broken bone or the impairment of some function of some important organ in your body. That's how you get second degree assault. So this was no small thing. But it sounds like these folks, and my guess is they're all guys, because even a group of girls tend to not be this stupid, although there's some video out there that suggests otherwise, that they're going to be prosecuted as juveniles, which means the consequences will be de minimis. Really de minimis. But wait, there's more. So now there's another case, and you may have followed this one. There were juveniles that started a fire in an apartment complex out of revenge. And it looks like the revenge was they got kicked out of some other apartment. They thought, that's it. I'll show you. I'm going to burn the apartment to the ground. And they do. And they end up murdering through that murder a mom and her young daughter. And they were buried this Tuesday. And it's a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old. Now, I'm looking at this article, and it's penned by the great Carol McKinley, one of the great reporters out there. And she writes this story. And again, just like the dude that got pushed off the platform in Lakewood, it takes place in Jefferson County. That's the first judicial district. And again, it does not mention the names of the offenders. That tells me, at least thus far, they're not being prosecuted as adults, and maybe they won't be, because it talks about the case being set up in this way. I'll read you the paragraph from the Gazette. First Judicial District Attorney Alexis King on Monday charged the 12 and 14-year-olds, who remain nameless, with two counts each of first-degree murder with extreme indifference. More about that in a moment. 39 counts of attempted murder with extreme indifference. That means there's 39 people in the building they set fire to. 15 counts of first-degree arson and one count each of felony criminal mischief and misdemeanor criminal mischief. Each of the young defendants also received 42 counts of juvenile aggravated sentence enhancers. That's okay, all right? But at the end of the day, that is not nearly the same thing as is available to the system if they're prosecuted as adults. And maybe the question has to be, should we be prosecuting 12 and 14-year-olds as adults in this circumstance? Maybe that's the open-ended question we have to have the debate on. But the reason it's all important is because on a daily basis now, you are opening up the paper, going online, and finding juveniles who are committing heinous acts. And they get treated much, much less seriously in the juvenile justice system. But our law in 2021 changed to apply that same hug-a-thug mentality to adult offenders who commit serious crimes. And so when you look at the Green Valley Ranch arson that took place, there was a big motions hearing that took place where the defense tried to suppress the evidence that the cops searched some phone search data in order to track down these killers. They killed five people. They killed five people, burned them to death, right? That search warrant got upheld by Judge Marty Egelhoff out of Denver. He's one of the great judges there, longtime judge, former chief deputy district attorney, I think under Bill Ritter, maybe even before that. and he struck down the defense motion. So that evidence is coming in, and now the article is written. And it's written by Julia Carty, and she says that in there that it sounds like the noise that they're making, and this is also true in the Denver Post, that those juveniles, they're not juveniles, those offenders who are like 18 and 19 may now want to enter pleas of guilty. Well, under the new law that the lefty legislature passed in 2021, I'm going to tell you when we come back from a break what that means, because they're going to have the option at a much more mitigated outcome than other adults have had and would have in the future. That is coming for us for an older group. The legislature, my prediction is going to expand the definition of those eligible for these juvenile softer outcomes, wait for it, to the age of 24 or 25. We're going to get to that law and what took place in 2021 when we come back. But before we do that, I want to tell you about a way to save some money in this ridiculous market. You heard Chris Brown from Common Sense Institute talk about the exploding costs of insurance, 10% increase on premiums this year on average. Well, if you want a guy who, even in this market, is willing to extend to you the benefit of, without any markup, the wholesale prices that he gets for kitchen and bathroom countertops and all those materials, that guy's name is Mitch Floria with the Art of Granite. Artogranite.com is the place that you go, and that's where you can explore some of the inventory and see what they do online. And that's a cool way to do it, but that's not the best way to do it. The best way to do it is to start there and then get in your car and drive out to about 6th Avenue and I-70 and go check out the inventory in person and have a conversation with Mitch, because he'll be there, as will his long-term employees. He'll also give you his cell phone number. I'll give you his cell phone number, 303-386-5919, 303-386-5919. And here's kind of the cool kicker. If you're looking to upgrade the interior of your house and you're like, I get it, wholesale prices helps, is there anything else? The answer is a big fat yes, there is. If you mention me and you mention 710 KNUS, when you say I want to do my kitchen countertop, they'll throw in the bathroom countertop for FREE. And you say, whoa, wait, George, I only want to do one room. I just want to do the kitchen countertop. That's cool. Then they'll throw in the sink for free. Or if you do the master bathroom, it's just the master bathroom sink for free. They're in the business of making people happy and improving your home. Let them do that for you. Check them out at theartofgranite.com or give Mitch a call at 303-386-5919. George Brockler on The George Show, 710 KNUS. George Brockler right back with you here on 710 KNUS. Listen, I got to change up a little bit here because I think woken from his slumber by his wife, who saw his phone vibrating, is our friend Matt Crane, who is a superstar in all things elections and the ED, the good kind, for the Colorado Clerks Association. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Hey, George. Good morning, sir.
Listen, before I return you back to your apricot face rub and your eye cover or whatever you use to sleep, I do want to ask you quickly, if you could, for the CD3 thing, here's what's going on. As you know, 540-something votes separate Frisch and Boebert. Boebert has declared she's the winner, but there's going to be this recount thing. What the hell does that mean? How does it work?
So when the margin between the two candidates is less than 0.5%, it triggers an automatic recount here in Colorado. So now what's going on, we still have some things to go before we can get to that point. So we have our risk-limiting audit, which is going to start in most counties this weekend to validate that the voting systems, in fact, counted those ballots properly. And then we go through the canvas and certification process. Once the election is certified, then the Secretary of State has to officially call the recount by December 5th. So during that time, the Secretary of State's office has to pay for the recount. So they'll be doing things like working up the cost of the recount, what they need to come up with in terms of money to fund it. And then sometime on or around December 5th, the recount will begin in the 3rd Congressional District.
So can we do, someone texted in here before when I posed this question back when you were sawing logs at home, and that is that,
hey, don't judge me, George. Don't judge me.
No, I'm not judging. I love it. I wish I could sleep in till noon, but then I'd be Stefan. Tell me, do they do a hand recount? Is that even on the table? I mean, is it just running the stuff back through the machine? I mean, how does it look different than what we just went through?
Yeah, so Colorado law is very specific here in that the recount must be conducted in the same manner in which the original election was conducted. So that means for counties that used a voting system, which is all but one county in Colorado, they have to use that voting system. There is a caveat for that. So before the logic and accuracy test, or excuse me, before the recount can start, there has to be a new logic and accuracy test that's run on the voting system. And so that's where the counties will have to take test ballots for this race, run them through, and validate that the system is functioning properly for the recount. Should that county fail the logic and accuracy test, then they would have to go to a hand recount as a part of that process. So that is the only condition under which a county that used a voting system for the initial count would do a hand count for the recount.
Now, we're still talking all paper ballots. I don't want people to freak out there and think that we're in some other state where there's some digital screen generating all this stuff.
That's absolutely right. Everybody in Colorado votes on a paper ballot.
Now, will Tina Peters be able to do the recount?
No, Tina Peters will not be able to do the recount.
Okay, that's a question one of the texters asked. something else. In the history of knowing these things that have gone on, and a recount isn't unheard of, it happens. I mean, it's just kind of a regular part of what takes place. What's the most you have seen the numbers move, and have you seen an election upended because of it? We're talking 540-something votes.
No, the numbers, so one thing that we know, despite the lies to the contrary, our voting systems here in Colorado are incredibly accurate. So, for instance, if we go back to the primary election where, you know, where Tina requested a recount, I think the vote total changed statewide by less than 40 votes. And that comes down to voter intent. So if the voter mismarks a ballot or doesn't mark it clearly, there's a bipartisan team that goes through the adjudication process and tries to determine voter intent. You could have you and I sit down and look at a ballot and the way somebody marked it and say, okay, we think this was a vote. But then if it's a different team doing adjudication during the recount, they could look at it differently and say, no, we think they really meant this or meant an undervote. But that's where these small, very small, slight variances come from, is those questions of voter intent.
But listen, and it would just shock me if 543 votes switch sides. I mean, wouldn't that seem historic?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
How many, if you had to guess?
What we've learned is these recounts.
Yeah, go ahead.
These recounts really hold up the initial count.
And how many, like, are we expecting to see one or two move? Would it shock you if it was more than 10%, less than, I mean, how about if it was zero?
Zero would surprise me only because of voter intent question. But again, in that statewide recount, I think there were over 620,000 ballots cast in the Secretary of State race on our side in the primary. And again, I think it was 13. Tina got 13 more. Pam got 13 more. And Mike, 11. So, you know, statewide, 630,000 votes, 620-some thousand votes, 37 changes. So that 0.00005% variance from the initial count. These systems are incredibly accurate, George.
And we have to get it all done by December the 13th. Is that right?
Affirmative. That is correct.
Is there a chance it's done before that? I mean, it just seems like such a long time.
I think so. You know, some of that depends on when the Secretary of State says, okay, let's go. But I think, you know, my hope would be that they would get it done before then. But the other thing, too, is we don't want to risk accuracy for speed. So let's just make sure we get it done and we get it done right. And then everybody can have confidence in the outcomes.
I've lived most of my private life by that very saying. Matt Crane, we're going to return you back to bed. Thank you for getting out to talk with us.
Anytime, sir. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Hey, that was Matt Crane, our subject matter expert here on all things election. He's the executive director of the Colorado Clerks Association. God, I love that guy's willing to just jump on in the middle of his working day. Hey, listen, when we come back, we're going to be joined by back-to-back VIP guests, including Lisa Hidalgo. She's a weather person from Channel 7. We're going to see if we can figure out what the hell's going on there. George Brockman on The George Show, 710 KNUS.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.